Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated July 15th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. From the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, above the fold, our first article is Bank Steps In Clouding Communities' Future by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Durham. Residents and builders in the Brightleaf at the Park community in eastern Durham are getting few answers to their questions about the future of the 684-acre development. Brightleaf's developer, Ryan Interest of Cincinnati, Ohio, has transferred ownership of its remaining developed lots and undeveloped land valued at $14.2 million into the care of SunTrust Bank of Atlanta, according to Durham County Deed Records. SunTrust won't say what it intends to do with the property, and homeowners are left to ponder a development where all the promised amenities haven't been delivered. Keith Pate, a real estate agent with Keller Williams Realty in Durham, who grew up in the area and now lives about a mile from Brightleaf, says, quote, "Brightleaf as a whole has been a good place, and the amenities certainly make it attractive to buyers, but there were a lot of other big plans for that area that haven't happened yet," end quote, including construction of retail shops and restaurants at Brightleaf. Retail and commercial developers have been slow to expand to Brightleaf, in part because of its proximity to the Briar Creek and Alexander Place retail and commercial developments, only 3 miles away at the Wake County line. Construction continues on new homes and townhouses in the community, a factor that can be a positive or a negative, depending on perspective. One Brightleaf homeowner, who Pate is representing, has dropped his asking price to $286,000 from $350,000 a year ago. Builders are dropping their prices so low that they are lower than the resales, Pate says. To me, that's not a good sign. Apartments are now on the way to Brightleaf. A South Carolina builder in late May broke ground on a 25-acre site near the community's entrance on US 70 for an upscale garden apartment community. Graystar Real Estate Partners of Charleston, South Carolina, expects to open the 328-unit Brightleaf apartment community in spring of 2012. Expectations for Brightleaf at the Park were high when construction of the community began in 2006. Its master plan includes subdivided lots for more than 2,000 single-family and multifamily housing units, with about 30% of its land reserved for walking trails, parks, and wooded areas. Local art students were commissioned to create sculptures that are incorporated into the landscaping. About 350 of the homes at Brightleaf have been built or are under construction, and 5 builder groups remain active in the community, including Dan Ryan Builders, Dries Homes, D.R. Horton, Standard Pacific Homes, and Shea Homes. New homes are priced from the $130,000s to the $500,000s. The 14-acre Brightleaf Club that opened in 2008 includes a pool complex large enough for swim team competitions, a fitness center, and a Tim Wilkinson signature tennis facility with 3 courts. Ryan donated 28 acres to Durham Public Schools for construction of Spring Valley Elementary School, which opened in 2009. All well and good, but so much of the development's future is now in the hands of bankers at SunTrust, and SunTrust spokesman Hugh Sir declined to comment. Sources say the bank has hired real estate advisory firm the Roseview Group of Boston, Massachusetts, to market the property to potential buyers. The Roseview Group represented SunTrust in the sale of the Hassentree Golf Course community in North Raleigh to Toll Brothers in 2010. Quote, "There's lots of rumors," says Jim Meadall of Charlotte, a developer who was a partner in the Brightleaf project with Ryan until 2 years ago. Meadall referred questions about the project to Ryan President Robert Ryan, who did not return calls for comment. Some residents are content with what they have and don't dwell on what's next for the neighborhood. Lorraine Angel Humphrey has lived at Brightleaf at the Park for 2.5 years and says it's like paradise because of its proximity to her office in the RTP, shopping at Briar Creek, and quick access to the main highways and interstates. Quote, "You are right in the middle of everything," she says. "The landscaping is beautiful and is well maintained. Everything is in keeping with the surroundings, and it's a nice price range for the whole community, whether you are single or a family with three kids. Today's lead article on the front page is titled Embroiled. Courts have handed down millions in awards against Raleigh real estate investor Carolyn Grant. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle and is from Raleigh. For years, Carolyn Grant built a network of investors, both locally and abroad, who were interested in real estate projects in North Carolina, relying in part on what one of those investors called a girls' club among those who knew Grant through her civic and charitable efforts. But in recent months, some of those investors have started lining up with their lawyers in tow, demanding payment of more than a dozen past due loans for projects that went sour after the real estate markets tumbled in 2008. To date, more than $3.2 million in Wake County civil court judgments have been handed down against Grant and her real estate company, Omega Property Group of Raleigh, and several other lawsuits in Wake County are pending. Among those suing is Phyllis Eller Moffitt, president and CEO of Quality Staffing Specialist in Cary, who says she loaned Grant $50,000 in 2009 for what was supposed to be a period of 30 days. She says she has not received any principal or interest. Eller Moffitt says she has been contacted by other people who had invested with Grant since she filed her lawsuit in Wake County. "We trusted her," says Eller Moffitt. This is sort of the girls' club gone wrong," end quote. Grant's list of investors includes multiple Triangle Women business leaders, local physicians, retired businessmen, small business owners, world-renowned racehorse trainer Dermot Weld of Ireland, and even the son of the late Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, Thurgood Marshall Jr. of Washington, D.C. Many met Grant through her activities with the Raleigh area charity and civic organizations, including a year as chair of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce and an unsuccessful run for Congress in 2002. Others say they met her through mutual acquaintances and were impressed with the return on investments that Grant was promising. According to a review of 75 promissory notes obtained by the Triangle Business Journal, Grant signed loan agreements worth $8.6 million with more than 50 different individuals between August 2006 and April 2010. Interest on the principal loan amounts varied widely from 3% on some to more than 40% for the long term. It is unknown how much of the total loan balance has been repaid or is still outstanding. Grant, when contacted at her Raleigh office, says she intends to pay back all of the money owed to her investors, but it will take more time than she had originally planned. Quote, "These people are mad, and I understand, but until real estate turns around, it's hard to pay people back," she says. "This is all due to the bad economy. There's a lot of developers out there like me. We don't have the income to pay these people back," end quote. Grant says most of the court judgments against her are related to a 101-lot residential subdivision in Raleigh that Grant hoped to sell to national home builder KB Home. Wake County deed records shows KB Home contracted in 2007 to purchase a 20-acre site that Grant and her partners owned near the intersection of Spring Forest Road and Lewisburg Road, but the deal never went through. The property has since been foreclosed and is owned by BB&T Bank. According to the promissory note documents, racehorse trainer Weld made a one-month loan to Grant in July 2009 for $1.13 million that came with an interest payment of $18,848 per month. Justice Marshall's son and his wife loaned Grant a combined $389,600 under three promissory notes issued in June 2009. It is unknown whether these notes have been paid or are any outstanding. Another investor in several of Grant's projects, Jim Good of Carolina Beach, says he has invested with and loaned Grant money since 2004. Many of the early loans were small, he says, and Grant stayed current on her repayments with interest until November 2008. "She came to us needing a loan for 30 to 45 days, and we got sucked in deeper and deeper," Good says. To date, according to a court judgment, Grant owes Good and his wife more than $1 million. Good questions whether he'll see his money again. Court documents show that Elizabeth Long of Cary, along with her husband, Cary Skin Center physician Robert Clark, and his business partner, Dr. Timothy Flynn, are owed more than $1 million in loans made to Grant. Quote, "We met in 2006 when we were attending the same gym," Long says of her introduction to Grant. "She found out I was married to a physician and asked me if he might be interested in investing in real estate," end quote. Long's attorney, Johnny Loper, says the group invested with her and was paid dividends, but in June 2008, Grant approached them about another real estate investment that was supposed to be a six-month deal. The trio are still awaiting payment from the $1 million-plus court judgment issued in February 2010, says Loper. Still on the front page, Underground Looks to Grow in City's Center, by Monica Chin. From Durham, American Tobacco Campus officials are looking to expand a successful tech startup space concept, American Underground, into the heart of Durham's downtown. Michael Goodman, Vice President of Real Estate for Capital Broadcasting Company and head of American Tobacco, has been making the rounds in Durham tech circles to gauge interest in expanding the concept to the Bargain Furniture Building, a structure at 309 East Chapel Hill Street that has a view of the city's Bronze Bull. Goodman did not respond to a request for comment. A spokesman for American Tobacco confirmed that the company is in very early talks regarding the building. Aaron Houghton, co-founder of iContact and owner of Preation, a small business web company located in American Underground, says Goodman has commissioned UNC Chapel Hill students to conduct a survey on market demand and to do further due diligence. "It sounds like they're really going to take everything they've learned about Underground and take it to the next level," Houghton says. "In this new space, it might have a new cafe with a big game room area. They want to take the shared culture of it to the next level," end quote. Bargain Furniture, a 22,004-square-foot building, is owned by Empire Alliance Properties, a partnership between Raleigh restaurateur and developer Greg Haddams, Empire Properties, and Durham architect John Warsalis, Alliance Architecture. Empire Alliance in 2005 bought the building, along with 322 East Chapel Hill Street for $2 million, according to Durham County Deed Records. Most recently, the namesake of the building, Bargain Furniture, which relocated some time ago, has been advised to move its remaining wares out of the building. When reached this week, Warsala declined to comment on American Underground, but commented on the Bull City Startup Stampede, the free space program by the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce that has also drawn tech startups to downtown this year. Quote, "Everyone was impressed with what happened with the Stampede," Warsala says, "so everyone is looking to have a building that will support startups and smaller tenants," end quote. Haddam did not return requests for comment. American Underground, located in the basement of the Crow and Strickland buildings in American Tobacco, opened on Halloween 2010 and is quickly filled up. In its first quarter, the 26,387-square-foot space had just 1,100 square feet vacant. If the concept expands into Bargain Furniture, it might provide a boost to the tech startup scene in downtown Durham, as well as provide some much-needed activity in the city center. James Avery, founder and president of AdZerk, a web advertising startup that recently raised $500,000, is looking to expand his company from 500 square feet to 1,300 square feet in American Underground in August. "As tech firms grow, they need flexible leases and a variety of options," Avery says. American Underground is allowing his company to move without signing a new lease. Quote, "If you look at the other spaces in Durham, many of them start at 4,000 square feet, which was way too big for a startup like us," Avery says. "But after we outgrow 1,300 square feet, where would we go from there?" End quote. Bargain Furniture is one of several recent moves by Capital Broadcasting to expand the 1-million-square-foot American Tobacco campus. In May, the company filed plans totaling 283,000 square feet for the third Diamond View office building, along with an annex behind the Durham Performing Arts Center and a wraparound structure for the parking deck beside the theater. Moving to the inside of the front cover, "Colleges Get a Green Light to Build Portfolios," by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, North Carolina's 58 community colleges have been given the green light to begin investing part of their funds into stocks, bonds, real estate, and other assets promising higher rates of returns than previous options. The expanding investing authority was included by lawmakers in the new state budget. With it, campuses across the state can begin appointing investment committees, hiring outside money managers, and developing portfolios. Just how much money the schools will begin sinking into new investments isn't known, but System Vice President Keenan Briggs puts the figure potentially in the millions. Quote, "We believe this is a win for the colleges and a win for students and for the system," says Briggs. It's the larger schools in the system, including Wake Technical Community College in Wake County and Piedmont Community College in Charlotte, that are expected to have the most unencumbered cash to put into investments. Wake President Stephen Scott was unavailable for comment. CFO Art Andrews declined to comment through school spokeswoman Michelle Favor. A state audit reveals that in 2009, Wake Tech had roughly $6.8 million in cash and cash equivalents, including money market accounts and bank deposits. The return was about $11,000, meager compared to what could be expected from higher return accounts now allowed. Durham Tech CFO Robert Keeney says he believes that most colleges using the new investment authority will set up endowments and use the returns to fund scholarships. Community colleges receive money primarily from three sources besides student tuition and fees. The state provides an annual appropriation to fund growth and operations. County governments provide money to maintain and expand community college facilities. The school also have what's known as institutional funds, which is money made up of gifts and donations made directly to the school and revenue generated from bookstores, food services, printing, and other similar operations. In the past, colleges were limited to putting institutional funds into certificates of deposit and other short-term, low-return investments. Under the new investing power, they can sink their institutional dollars into a wide variety of longer-term investments. Most of the stock investing is expected to be in mutual funds. Gifts and donations made to foundations affiliated with each community college aren't affected by the rules change and are already being invested in longer-term assets. Briggs says the expanded authority is the outcome of a difference of opinion that surfaced back in 2009 between the state auditor's office and two colleges, Isothermal Community College in Spindale, near Rutherfordton, and Vance Granville Community College. In Isothermal's case, the school had set up an endowment with a $9 million gift it had received, spreading the cash among the various investment assets. State auditors questioned the move but agreed to hold off on finding out until the issue could be hashed out. The measure lawmakers included in the new state budget was the outcome of those talks. Next up, border costs. Online education expenses skyrocket with new rule. By Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. New U.S. Department of Education regulations could cost universities hundreds of thousands of dollars to offer online courses outside their home states, prompting some administrators in the Triangle to consider eliminating nationwide course offerings. The rules, which went into effect July 1, force universities to apply and gain permission in each state in which students sign up for courses. NC State University, for example, would pay a combined $823,000 in out-of-state fees, much of that annually, in order to offer online education in every state. Duke University, which doesn't have an extensive a collection of online offerings, as does NCSU, faces spending $100,000 in state fees. It's nothing new for universities to pay fees in states in which they establish a physical presence, but fees have never before been applied to online curriculum offerings. Quote, "We want to have geography with no barriers, but there are going to be some insurmountable barriers with these new regulations," says Rebecca Swanson, NCSU Vice Provost for Distance Education. "As you can imagine, this has been a real challenge for us," she says. NC State is a land-grant institution with full online programs. Many of them focus in very specific fields of science, technology, and engineering. As such, its courses attract widespread and growing interest. Last spring, 12% of students enrolled in NCSU's distance education program were outside North Carolina, with at least one student from every state except Nevada. All 50 states were represented in the full school year. Out-of-state distance education tuition totaled $4.9 million for the full year, and online enrollment has averaged 20% growth every year since 2007, including 29% growth going into last year, Swanson says. The regulations are intended to target institutions that enroll students online but do not offer credible degrees. These institutions, which critics sometimes call diploma factories, accept students who pay with federal or state tuition grants. Representatives of credible universities agree that such offerings should be eliminated, but argue there are other ways to police the bad apples. Already, NCSU administrators are forming a shopping list. University officials say that because of high fees and relatively low demand, they're likely not to seek approval to offer courses in 11 states. In Massachusetts, for example, the university would pay $140,000 to offer its online programs. Quote, "I'm loath to have to post on our website that a student from any state is not welcome," Swan says, "but it might come to that." Full implementation of the regulations don't take hold until 2014, but universities must show a good faith effort if they are working toward adhering to them. In the meantime, Chris Simmons, a lobbyist for Duke University, and others are working to get the regulation rescinded. U.S. Senator Richard Burr and U.S. Representative Virginia Fox, both North Carolina Republicans, filed bills to that effect in June. This week, Judge Rosemary Collier of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia ruled against forcing universities to apply for state authorization, something both Burr and Fox applaud. Still, the judge found fault with procedure only, not with the actual content of the regulations. It remains unclear what effect the ruling will actually have on universities or how the Department of Education will proceed. The National Governors Association and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have come out against the regulations. The U.S. Department of Education released a statement saying only that it is, quote, "still reviewing the opinion and considering our options for future action," end quote. Next up, Triangle in Line for Drug Center, by Monica Chin. From Chapel Hill. With a new industry cluster having emerged here in the field of what's called translational research, the Triangle could be in line for a major new research center. Winding its way through Congress is a proposal to build what's being called the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, which is being championed by Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health. Where such a center might be built has not been decided, nor has the funding been allocated. It would become an institute within the NIH, which operates 27 institutes nationwide. One of those is the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, NRTP, which the NIH maintains on a campus of 377 acres. Translational research is aimed at improving the process of taking drugs to market. Collins is a booster of the field, and in a paper published on July 6th, he discussed the need for a coordinated approach to fostering its development. Comparing the effort to start a translational center with the scale and significance of the Human Genome Project in the 1990s, Collins wrote, quote, "As was the case with genomics, translational science needs to shift from a series of one-off solutions towards a more comprehensive strategy," end quote. The Triangle's three research universities have established translational research institutes over the past decade, as have RTI International and the Hamner Institutes for Health Sciences. The emerging field has been built in large by NIH funding. For instance, UNC Chapel Hill's NC Translational and Clinical Sciences Institute, NTRACS, opened in 2006 and had a budget of about $19 million for 2011. The center has been a facilitator of major grants from the NIH, including a $32 million in HIV research funding announced July 11. Since its founding, the institute has received 300 smaller grants, ranging from $2,000 to $50,000 each. As a Clinical and Translational Science Awards, CTUS, site, and NTRACS get about 50% of its funding from the NIH, says Chief Operating Officer Rosemary Simpson. If a national translational research center becomes reality, it would take over the CTSA grants program, along with oversight. In that eventuality, quote, we'll be much more involved in the drug discovery and develop a program that should have major focus on relieving the bottlenecks of drug approvals, Simpson says. We'll still do everything we're doing now, but we'll be much more focused on drug discovery and development, end quote. Duke University's Translational Medicine Institute is also a CTOS state. Site. RTI, although not an academic institution, founded its Translational Institute, the Molecular Epidemiology, Genomics, Environment, and Health Center, MEGA, in April with an initial budget of $2 million. In the past year, the center has pulled in $10 million to $15 million in total grants from the NIH, the U.S. Department of Defense, and other government bodies. MEGA now has 30 employees, including 10 in Baltimore and 20 in RTP. Peter Schad, director of the center, says he expects to hire another 10 researchers in RTP this year. Translational research is where the life science industry is headed, says Schad, and the NIH's new center could grow the funding available through perhaps not immediately. It could, quote, increase the dollars considerably, but it's a brand new institute. It's probably going to take 3 or 4 years before we see anything come out of that, Schad says. The move towards translational research, as with some of the other shifts in the drug industry in recent years, is the result of slowdowns in the drug commercialization process. The average length of time from target discovery to approval of a new drug is about 13 years, according to NIH, with a failure rate of 95% and the cost per successful drug at $1 billion. Translational research is a bench-side-to-bedside approach aimed at improving those numbers. The next article is titled, As State Aid Wanes, Charity Care Spirals at UNC Hospitals, by Jason DeBruin from Chapel Hill. Even as North Carolina's public hospital system receives less state funding, its uncompensated care costs continue to rise, creating a roadmap to higher costs for patients who pay and their insurers, hospital layoffs, and service cuts. UNC Healthcare, which manages UNC hospitals, has seen its uncompensated care costs increase by 36% since 2008, from $270 million that year to a projected $350 in the fiscal year that began July 1. Meanwhile, the state funding intended to offset charities, cost of charities, or indigent care to the state's poorest patients has declined by 62%, from $47 million to $18 million in that same time period. Every hospital provides some level of uncompensated care, calculated by the difference in cost a hospital incurs in treating Medicaid and Medicare patients, charity care and bad debt, and the payments it actually receives from those patients. UNC is not alone in seeing that number go up. According to statistics from Blue Cross and Blue Shield North Carolina, uncompensated care costs nationally increased by 15% from 2007 to 2009, ballooning to $39.1 billion. In addition, hospital stays for uninsured patients grew to 2.1 million admissions in the U.S. in 2008, a 21% increase from 2003. The average cost for an uninsured hospital stay in 2008 was $7,300. The overriding reason for the increased care is simple. A bad economy means more patients who can no longer afford to pay for insurance or for care. For their part, WakeMed Health and Hospitals and Duke University Health System have shouldered uncompensated care, but since they are not public hospitals, they do not receive state compensation, as does UNC. WakeMed at its main Raleigh campus and its Cary Hospital reported $137 million of uncompensated care in the fiscal year ending 2008, and $168 million and $162 million respectively in fiscal years ending in 2009 and 2010, matching a similar curve as UNC. Duke, which includes Duke Raleigh and Durham Regional, shows a similar pattern as WakeMed. In fiscal year 2007-08, Duke reported $184 million in uncompensated care, and in 2009 and 2010, it reported $207 million and $204 million, respectively. WakeMed CFO Mike Devon points out that his hospital receives no state money, and UNC hospitals in Chapel Hill receive a higher Medicaid reimbursement rate than surrounding hospitals because it is a public institution. These are among the arguments WakeMed has made in support of its bid to buy Rex Hospital in Raleigh from UNC Hospitals. Financial pressures mean more cost shifting and higher bills for those with health insurance. Quote, "The only place where the health care system makes up for the cost of uncompensated care is in the charges that are paid by paying patients," says Karen McCall, a UNC Healthcare vice president. Quote, "And UNC Healthcare is not alone in that model. The entire healthcare financial system is set up this way," she says. To be sure, hospitals have looked for efficiencies, but when revenues don't match costs, it could mean fewer doctors or nurses. Or services cut entirely, says Don Dalton, NC Hospital Association Director of Public Affairs. He says, hospitals are near, if not already, reaching the limit of cost shifting. Our concern is that we are going to see services get cut out of hospitals around the state. And if services are cut, it's not just Medicaid and Medicare that are cut. It's everyone in that community. End quote. To be sure, UNC Healthcare has grown since 2008. The system added 150 licensed beds in the past 5 years, and its revenue has grown to $2 billion. During the recession, uncompensated care increased as a percentage of total revenue to roughly 6% of its total budget and has held there for 2 years. Quote, "That's part of being a safety net institution," says UNC Healthcare CEO Bill Roper. End quote. For comparison, Duke University Health System is about the same size as UNC Healthcare, but WakeMed is less than half the size of both in terms of total revenue. Dalton and McCall point to the federal government as part of the reason for increased cost shifting and potential loss of service. In congressional talks about a deal to increase the federal debt ceiling, one option would cut another $700 million that hospitals in North Carolina now get, Dalton says. Quote, "There is a reason why people have been trying to find a better way to finance health care," McCall says. "It's really important for the people to qualify for insurance. For places like UNC, the ability for patients to have insurance is absolutely critical." End quote. Continuing on the inside, Research Campus, spared in budget cutting, will get a new leader. By Jennifer Thomas. From Chapel Hill. The University of North Carolina system is searching for an executive director to lead its operations at the NC Research Campus. It will be the university's system's first administrative post dedicated to the Kannapolis Biotech Hub, which is focused on health, nutrition, and agriculture. The 350-acre research campus, founded by California billionaire David Murdoch, is home to operations of 7 UNC system universities. Roughly 140 employees from the system schools work there. "The goal is to fill the position by Labor Day or shortly thereafter," says Steve Leith, UNC System Vice President for Research. "We feel it's time to have someone on the campus full-time," Leith says of the director's post. "I think it will just help the campus move forward." The new role also signifies the university system's commitment to the campus. The UNC system saw a 12% budget cut for the fiscal year that began July 1, but the state's $23.5 million allocation to the research campus was spared from those reductions. Leith notes few new jobs are being added within the university system. Quote, "With the state's investment in Kannapolis and Mr. Murdoch's investment there, this was one of the few positions we're going to move forward with," end quote. Leith says the salary range will be based on the top candidate's skills. The director will oversee day-to-day operations, including administrative, budget, and facilities responsibilities. That could mean negotiating contracts or purchase agreements, as well as allocating funds to the university partners on campus. The role also involves coordinating activities across campus, helping to form partnerships among the universities and private companies with operations on site, as well as with the David H. Murdoch Research Institute. That state-of-the-art research facility supports scientific operations on the campus. The Institute also hopes to fill a key leadership role post by Labor Day. Its first president, Mike Luther, has taken a business development role with the Research Institute, and a search is underway for a new president. Leith, who serves as chief executive of the Research Institute, is leading both searches. The new UNC system position will aid efforts to work with campus developer Kessel & Cook, North Carolina. Leith notes, "I think you'll see the campus grow faster and be more of the cooperative campus it's planned to be," he says. The position will help build on the relationship between Kessel & Cook and the university system, says Lynn Scott Saffert, president of the development firm. For this article, Jennifer Thomas is noted that she writes for the Charlotte Business Journal. Job bleeding will go on post-merger, Progress CEO says. By John Downey. From Frankfort, Kentucky. Job cuts from Duke Energy Corp's $13.7 billion purchase of Raleigh-based Progress Energy Incorporated could continue for a few years after the merger, Progress Chief Executive Bill Johnson told Kentucky regulators last week. That would be beyond the reduction sought in the voluntary severance program Duke and Progress will offer employees this fall. During the first public hearing on the merger, Johnson told the Kentucky Public Service Commission significant upfront operational savings in the Carolinas will give Duke the luxury of time in deciding how to most efficiently integrate the two companies. Quote, "We don't have to wring out our integration savings immediately," he says. "We can let those flow over time," end quote. Johnson, slated to become Duke's CEO after the merger, elaborated in an interview following the hearing. Quote, "I would expect the big impact is in the first year," he said. "But it will continue in smaller pieces for another year, maybe 2 years after that," end quote. Johnson and current Duke CEO Jim Rogers were the two principal witnesses at the hearing July 8th in Frankfort, Kentucky. Kentucky and North Carolina are the only states among the six affected by the merger that have the authority to approve or reject the deal. North Carolina's hearings are scheduled for September. Hearings also will be held this fall in South Carolina, but that state has authority over only the company's plans to eventually combine their utilities, Duke Energy Carolinas and Progress Energy Carolinas. South Carolina regulators have no direct say on the merger of the parent corporations. Duke hasn't agreed to forego any general rate increases in Kentucky for 2 years as a concession to win the support of customer advocates in that state. But Johnson and Rogers both say such an agreement would be impossible in North Carolina. "Regulators know we couldn't agree to that," Johnson says. "They know where both companies are in their construction program and how much capital we've laid out. I wouldn't expect those kinds of conditions in North Carolina at all." Duke recently submitted a request for a 15% rate hike in North Carolina. Rogers says the company is likely to seek a similar increase in South Carolina. Duke also plans for another rate hike request, expecting to be smaller for 2014. Johnson says Progress Energy Carolinas will seek its first rate increase since 1991 at about the same time. Some consumer advocates in the Carolinas have already called for cutting Duke's requested 15% increase. And regulators often use merger proposals as leverage to win concessions from utilities. But Rogers and Johnson say they don't expect the rate increases to be an issue in the merger hearings in North Carolina. And both say the merger should help reduce the size of the increase the utilities seek in 2014. In addition to rate concession, Duke has agreed in Kentucky to spend $250,000 more on economic development in that state during the next 5 years, as well as $575,000 more on weatherization for low-income houses. But the Kentucky Commission still asked to be apprised of what concessions Duke makes in the Carolinas, raising the possibility that the Tar Heel and Palmetto states could ask for additional concessions. With the settlement of Duke and Progress recently made with most of their potential opponents in Kentucky, the testimony in the hearings lasted only about 3.5 hours. Many of the questions from the three-person commission surrounded the future of Duke's operations in Kentucky and the long-term prospects for coal-fired plants, an important issue for a coal-producing state. Rogers and Johnson were generally reassuring on both counts. Most job losses would likely occur in the Carolinas, they said, and coal would remain an important resource. Quote, Bill Johnson and I have had numerous conversations about this, Rogers said when he was asked about coal. We both believe we need to spend more on R&D dollars on cleaner coal, Johnson proclaimed, himself an unabashed advocate for coal and nuclear power plants. The companies have cited up to $600 million in savings on fuel and other power generation expenses over 4 years in the Carolinas as an immediate benefit of the merger. At last week's hearing, Commission Counsel Richard Raff inquired about potential savings for Kentucky customers, and he asked about the possibility that, after the merger, Duke might seek to sell its unregulated businesses, as Progress Energy did several years ago. Johnson replied there were no discussions and no intent for now to sell those businesses. The unregulated units include power operations in South America, the solar and wind projects of Duke Energy Renewables, and merchant plants in the Midwest. He later said he wouldn't expect any final decisions on unregulated businesses until well after the merger is accomplished. It should be noticed that John Downey writes for the Charlotte Business Journal as well, a sister publication. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen, Conservancy aims for partnerships. After receiving a 269-acre nature preserve in southern Orange County from the estate of Eleanor Irvin in 2007 to be used for conservation and agricultural purposes, Triangle Land Conservancy began talking to potential partners about using the land. A group of educators in Chatham and Orange counties wanted to design an environmental curriculum. The Raleigh-based Interfaith Food Shuttle wanted to work with volunteers to grow local food for distribution to low-income communities. And the Orange County Partnership for Young Children was looking for subsistence farming sites for Burmese refugees. But none of the groups had any land. Those talks led to the creation of three projects at the preserve. Irvin Learning Farm, a program launched in 2008 for the group Learning Outside, has provided environmental education for 300 elementary school students, mainly from low-income families. Healthy Choices Garden, a three-acre garden launched in 2010, managed by the Interfaith Food Shuttle and worked by volunteers that produces food for the seven-county region the nonprofit serves. A farming site for refugees. The partnerships, says Kevin Bryce, president of Triangle Land Conservancy, represent a strategy the organization will continue to pursue to help carry out its goals of safeguarding water quality, keeping local farms and fruit in the community, protecting wildlife habitat, and connecting people with nature. Formed in 1983, the organization has helped protect 14,600 acres in Wake, Durham, Orange, Chatham, Johnston, and Lee counties through easements and acquisitions. The group owns roughly 4,000 of those acres and also has played the role of acquiring land, then transferring it to other conservation partners. Operating with an annual budget of $1 million, Triangle Land Conservancy generates 75% of its annual budget through contributions and the remainder from project grants and earnings on investments and its endowment. And in June 2010, he completed a four-year capital campaign that raised $5.5 million, including $4 million for a revolving loan fund, $1 million for a stewardship fund, and $500,000 to finance the campaign, which was advised by Carol O'Brien Associates in Durham. The revolving loan fund already has helped the Triangle Land Conservancy complete 43 land projects, totaling about 3,700 acres, Bryce says. The group used the fund, for example, to purchase 613 acres from the Atlanta-based Zeist Foundation, which had a specific timeline and urgency for the selling of the property, Bryce says. With funds from the revolving loan fund, Triangle Land Conservancy purchased the land, which includes 5 miles of stream that empty into Falls Lake, and then applied to the North Carolina Clean Water Management Trust Fund for reimbursement. The trust fund, established in 1996, has received over $1 billion from state lawmakers and at its peak received $100 million a year, compared to just over $11 million it received in the recently passed state budget. The recession, Bryce says, has had a profound impact on that investment of public dollars. As a result of the depressed economy, he says, we are seeing an increase in interest of donations of land for conservations for purposes. It should be noted that Cohen is editor and publisher of the Philanthropy Journal. On the next page, we find an article about Campbell's Medical School and its aims to help ease doctor shortage. This article is by Jason DeBroom. It's from Buies Creek. When Campbell University opens its medical school, scheduled for 2013, it will be the state's only school of osteopathic medicine targeted at easing an ever-worsening shortage of primary care physicians. Quote, the need for primary care in the state of North Carolina became so obvious on our radar, says Britt Davis, vice president of institutional advancement at Campbell, most individuals specialize in something and fewer are going into primary care. End quote. Statistics back that up. Between 1997 and 2005, medical school graduates in North Carolina who chose primary care declined by 50%. Already, North Carolina has fewer primary care physicians at 8.8 per 10,000 residents than the national average of 9.43 per 10,000 residents, according to Campbell Research. A survey by 13 doctors published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that only 23.2% of medical students intended to enter a career of internal medicine, with only 2% going into general internal medicine. The rest planned to pursue a specialized or combined field with a variety of reasons, including better work schedules and compensation. By offering osteopathic medicine, leaders of the planned med school at Campbell hope to play a role in reversing that trend. As many as 60% of osteopathic medicine graduates go into primary care, says Davis, a field Campbell will encourage its doctors to pursue. Indeed, the, quote, mission statements of the majority of osteopathic medical schools state plainly that their purpose is the production of primary care physicians, end quote, according to the American Association of Colleges of Osteopathic Medicine. Part of the heritage of osteopathic medicine is primary care and serving the underserved, says Wendy Fernando, a vice president with the AACOM. We need to increase the number of physicians in the pipeline, she says. Osteopathic medicine takes a holistic approach to treatment that focuses on the body's ability to heal itself. Doctors consider the impact that lifestyle and community have on the health of patients and work with the body as a whole instead of a collection of organs. Graduates from an osteopathic medical school earn a DO, or Doctor, of Osteopathic Medicine, instead of the traditional MD for medical doctor. DOs account for 63,000 of the nation's estimated 950,000 doctors and can be licensed to practice the full scope of medicine in all 50 states, according to the AACOM. Unlike Campbell's Law School, which is in Raleigh, the university's medical school will be on its main campus in Buies Creek, and the area is expected to benefit economically, according to a study commissioned by the school. Construction alone will account for 278 jobs and a $37.7 million infusion into the local economy, projects Michael Walden, an economics professor at NC State University who did the analysis. Walden considered the impact of the medical school in the federally defined Raleigh-Durham Metropolitan Statistical Area, which includes the counties of Wake, Durham-Orange, Chatham County, Franklin, Harnett, Johnston, and Person County. Buies Creek is in Harnett County. In total operating, research and student and alumni spending, he projects the area should expect a spending impact of $295.7 million and an additional 1,158 jobs by 2024. The medical school at Campbell will admit 150 students per year, which would make it the second largest medical school in the state, behind only University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. For comparison, Wake Forest University enrolls 120, Duke University enrolls 100, and East Carolina University enrolls 78 at their respective medical schools per year. UNC admitted 160 students last year, but will increase enrollment to 170 in the coming year and to 180 in the 2012-13 year, says Bill Roper, dean of the UNC School of Medicine. The Campbell Medical Facility will cover 90,000 square feet with 5,100 square feet of primary examination and instruction areas and two lecture halls of 4,000 square feet each. The initial startup costs are estimated at $60 million. Next up, First Citizens takes lead, assets-wise in buying failed banks. Raleigh's Bank's latest acquisition and deal arranged by Feds is purchase of $718 million Colorado institution. This article is by Lee Weisbecker, and it's from Raleigh. With its acquisition of yet another Colorado bank, Raleigh-based First Citizens has emerged as the top buyer of failed banks in the United States in terms of assets brought into the fold. The latest transaction, announced July 8, brought First Citizens' acquisition total to six since July 2009, only one fewer than the Bank of the Ozarks, a Little Rock, Arkansas lender with similar growth strategy. First Citizens' deals have been considerably larger than those of Ozarks, though ranging from $500 million in total assets up to around $2 billion. The Arkansas Bank, by contrast, has been picking up failed banks on average in the $400 million range. Quote, First Citizens is certainly one of the leading multiple bank buyers, says analyst Brett Shaner of Arlington, Virginia-based FBR Capital Markets. And I don't think they are finished, he says. He believes First Citizens has the wherewithal to purchase an additional $500 million to $1 billion in banking assets. But only if the deal is good, he says. The bank's latest acquisition of $718 million total asset Colorado Capital Bank, like First Citizens' earlier deals, was under a loss share agreement with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Under such agreements, the regulatory agency agrees to pick up a percentage of potential losses on the acquired loan portfolio. Other leading multiple bank buyers in such FDIC-assisted transactions, according to Patrick Sims of Charlottesville, Virginia-based SNL Financial, are Ameris Bancorp of Moultrie, Georgia, which has bought six, MB Financial of Chicago, they've bought five, and Conway, Arkansas-based Home Bank Shares, and they have purchased five also. First Citizens of South Carolina has made three failed bank acquisitions. If those are added to the Raleigh tally for a total of nine, banking institutions with members of Raleigh's holdings family in key ownership positions unambiguously lead in the failed bank dash. First Citizens of Raleigh and First Citizens of Columbia, South Carolina are operated as separate institutions but are linked by keen ownership ties. Carmen Holding Ames and her uncle, Frank B. Holding, are major shareholders and board members at both banking operations. Holding, 82, is also the father-in-law of First Citizens of South Carolina CEO Peter Bristow. First Citizens of Raleigh spokeswoman Barbara Thompson says Colorado Capital was an attractive acquisition primarily due to its proximity to the branch network First Citizens assumed when it acquired another Denver-area bank, United Western, in January. First Citizens' other acquisitions include Temecula Valley Bank near Oceanside, California, First Regional Bank of Los Angeles, California, the Venture Bank in Lacey, Washington, and Boca Raton, Florida-based Sun American. Shiner says some of the assets, including loan portfolios, that First Citizen has picked up in the transactions have performed better than others, but on the whole have offered up few, if any, major surprises. To make repeated buys, he adds, First Citizens essentially has created an acquisition engine, adding people and accounting capacity. And once you have the engine in place, it only makes sense to do more deals, he says. From the Reporter's Notebook of Barbara Pinckney, do your homework before seeking a loan. In most ways, a loan backed by the Small Business Administration is just like any other loan, and the process for getting one is much the same. The borrower applies to the bank, and the bank decides if he or she meets the criteria for credit. If the bank determines it cannot make the loan on its own, it may then look to an SBA program, most commonly the 7A guarantee program. If the SBA agrees, it will guarantee a portion of the credit, typically 75% or more. There are pros and cons for the borrower. Working with the SBA typically allows banks to offer rates and terms they wouldn't offer otherwise. But there are also fees that range from 2% to 3.75% of the guaranteed portion of the loan, depending on loan size. For example, a $250,000 7A loan with a 75% guarantee would carry a $5,625 fee. Bernard Paparocki, director of the SBA's Syracuse, New York district, said it is important that entrepreneurs and business owners understand how this process works. A borrower should not go into a bank thinking they want an SBA loan. The goal is just to get a loan, he says. Going into the bank is actually one of the last steps in the process. First comes research and preparation. Whether you are starting a new business or expanding an existing one, you need a solid business plan, reasonable cash flow projections, and a good sense of the competitive landscape. Your chances of getting a loan are greatly enhanced when you do your homework first, Paparocki says. Thomas Burke, Vice President of SBA Lending for San Francisco-based Wells Fargo & Company, advised getting help from an outside expert, such as an accountant, a business consultant, or one of the organizations affiliated with the SBA. These include small business development centers, which typically are tied to large universities, women's business centers, and SCORE, a group of retired executives who mentor entrepreneurs. All three provide their services at little or no cost. Burke, whose bank is the nation's largest SBA lender, also likes to see entrepreneurs with some experience, preferably managerial in the industry they want to enter. It also is important to have some of your own money to invest. We want you to have skin in the game, he says. For a startup, the norm is 30%. For existing businesses, it may be 10 or 20%. One of the keys to getting what you need from a bank is also knowing what you need. A line of credit? A term loan? A 7A loan is a term loan, Burke said. That is good if you are purchasing a business or a big piece of equipment you want to pay off over time. But what if you need is working capital? You may be better off with a line of credit. The SBA Express product is the line of credit, he says. It is also wise, he said, to keep expectations reasonable. It is better and easier to borrow $20,000 now and more later than to get in over your head by asking for $200,000 now. It should be like building blocks, Burke said. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is triangleradioreadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.